When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Farah.
So today we've got Kwame Kweama, the artistic director of the Young Vic, one of the UK's leading theatres. And in that spirit, our quick fire round is going to be around the world of theatre, arts and performance. Are you ready?
Great. Let's go for it.
Romeo and Juliet or Macbeth?
I think Macbeth. First of all, it's not too long. Which I think is quite a... just showing off my artistic credentials there. No, I think Macbeth... actually, not too long before lockdown, I went to see Macbeth at the Barbican and it was just absolutely incredible.
I love the fact that you prioritised performance time over plot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, let's just keep it real.
Well, let's go to musicals. I don't know if you're a musical fan, but if you are, Hamilton or Les Mis?
I can say categorically, without hesitation, that I'm not a musicals fan. I resisted for the vast majority of my life ever going to a musical. And you may say, how did you know you weren't a musicals fan? But I'm going to stand my ground on that one. So I never went to a musical. And then I went to Hamilton and I took a client to Hamilton. And I was sitting there with sort of about 15 minutes to go next to my quite important client. Sobbing my eyes out and sort of going, no, it's honestly, it's fine. I've just got something in my eye. Honestly, it's absolutely fine. So not a musicals fan, but got something in my eye when I watched Hamilton. So couldn't quite see the end.
Well, I love the fact you're a combat. Hamilton is absolutely amazing. And I may have learned most of the lyrics to most of the songs.
I've been to see it twice and I got something in my eye at the end both times.
How about the West End or Broadway?
So I can't pretend to have ever off regularly been to plays on Broadway, but I think the West End is the best in the world.
How about theatre versus cinema?
That's an easy one for me, theatre.
Interesting. I wasn't expecting that. I thought you might go for cinema.
I really very rarely watch films. I'm very, very picky about films.
Oh, well, Kwame is going to love that answer. Let's go to the episode.
Hello and welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership podcast brought to you by Intelligence Squared. I'm Chris Hurst, author of No Bullshit Leadership, and in my day job, I'm global CEO of Havas Creative Group. Leadership is difficult but not complicated. In this podcast series, I want to help you cut through the bullshit and get to the heart of modern leadership, which, put simply, is the power to get stuff done and make stuff happen. In each episode, I'm joined by a different inspirational leader who is doing just that, leading change in their worlds of business, sport, or politics. I'm delighted to be joined in this episode by the playwright and director, Kwame Kweama. He's currently the artistic director of the Young Vic Theatre, where he's directed plays including Twelfth Night and Tree. Previously, he was the artistic director of Baltimore Centre Stage and the associate director of the Donmore Warehouse, where he directed the Olivier-nominated play One Night in Miami. He's a prolific playwright, won myriad of awards, sat on the boards of theatres including the National, got an OBE for his services to drama, and even directed the opening ceremony of Senegal's Senghor National Stadium. Kwame Kweama, welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership podcast.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
So we're going to kick things off, as we always do, with our quick fire round, just to get us going. So in three words, describe your leadership style.
I want to say no bullshit, right? But I'd say I attempt to be inclusive, dynamic, and soulful.
Great. I love all three of those. And if you could delete any word from the business bullshit jargon dictionary, what would it be?
KPI.
KPI. Yep. And which leader do you most admire? Modern, past?
That's very interesting because I came into management because a friend of mine once said, you know, our heroes are Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey. And actually they were external leaders of organizations, but not necessarily inside of organizations creating change. And that maybe the baton is that my generation was to move inside and revolutionize from the inside. So it's really hard to answer that question because in truth, I don't really have a kind of business role model. I really admire Oscar Eustace, who runs the Public Theatre in New York, a theatre that I've worked with a lot. And I really admire an artistic director called Hannah Sharif, who runs the Repertory Theatre in St. Louis, again in America, just because there's no bullshit to her leadership. It's just eyes forward and just bring the change through. And those are the kind of managers or people that inspire me.
Fantastic. Well, we'll, I'm sure, get into some of that as we go along. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
1 year in the mind of an artistic director is 3 years in the real world. Therefore, be patient.
Given that, what has the last 1 year felt like? That must be 30 years.
A lifetime?
Yeah.
Yeah, for real.
What's the best decision you've ever made?
To hire Hannah Sharif as my associate artistic director at Baltimore Center Stage.
And I think our listeners' favorite question, I'm not sure whether it's our guests' favorite question for last, what's the worst decision you've ever made?
Oh. I think we all make many, right? And I'm sorry, you said quickfire, so I should be prepared for it. It's interesting. I often think about what is probably the most dangerous decision that I've made. I tend to eject out of my brain failures. And so really, I think the worst decision that I ever made is I was in a situation where I wanted to impress a peer. And a question came to me, which was, when should I meet a writer? And my instinct was, let's do it now. We should do it now. And that person said, or the peer said, no, let's not do it. And although my instinct and everything in me said, no, we really should, I made the decision possibly to try and impress is even the wrong word, but to try and equalize our relationship. And I kind of went, yeah, great, I'll follow whatever you say. And it came back to bite me in the ass really, really, really hard.
Wow, that's a great answer. I also, by the way, I think I now prefer the question, what's the most dangerous decision you've ever made? I think that's a far, far, far better question. So thank you. So let's get into it a bit then. So I think these days, maybe we're coming to the end of this point, but these days it's still the case that we almost always have to start every conversation by asking about COVID. But we've all had a tough year, I think, but the theatre and the arts have been hit particularly hard. How have you managed to lead your organisation through such a tumultuous, maybe even existential crisis?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right. It did feel and does feel almost existential. And I also think it's really easy to answer that question from a leadership position when really the people who should answer that are the people that you've been leading.
Yeah.
But what I'll try and articulate has been my philosophy. What's my philosophy been throughout this? And my philosophy has been, my parents are of West Indian extraction. And so there is a saying that my father and my mother would often say, which is pump the brakes. And at one point, so if ever I was making a decision too quickly or I was trying to race through my homework or trying to be like, hey, look, pump the brakes, slow down. And I think I've tried to do that throughout this crisis, which is understandably many people and many leaders have tried to fill the void, have gone, we've got to do something now. Theatre's not open and we're closed and let's... And I've tried to actually just go, no, I'm just going to be steady. I'm not very good with groupthink. And the moment that groupthink says, let's do X, I lean away from that.
Yes, I'm the same. Not always to my benefit, but as I,
yeah,
I have to catch myself. But I agree with you. As soon as I'm told what everybody else thinks, I think, do they really? Why?
Why? I'm really bad with that. I'm really, really bad. So I think really how I've tried to manage this is to kind of just be as steady as possible. Be as cognizant of the mental health of the organization. And be cognizant of our financial health. I have a brilliant board and board chair. And so I know that I can always refer and seldom defer, but I can refer to them and think about whether I'm making the right decision in not acting. So in truth, I have been leading the organization by doing a lot of advocacy at the government level. I've been doing a lot of advocacy in terms of looking after the emotional health of our sector by doing many interviews and podcasts and webinars and also to myself, not inhaling any of the news that I'm given. I take it, I go, okay, so we're due to open on blah, blah, blah. Let's continue to plan in case that happens, but let's prepare ourselves in case that doesn't.
You made a really interesting point about maybe the people that I should ask that question of, you know, of us all, by the way, but in your case, the people you've been leading. I mean, I think it's a great point. How have you gone about doing that in practice? Is that something that you've said, okay, maybe I do need to find different ways to check in with people?
Yeah, I tried 3 or 4, 5 or 6 different methods. You know, I tried to do in our company meetings, I try and spend time just going, look, everybody tell me how you're feeling and I'll start with me. And then we'll try and cater some of our decisions, particularly as we had to slightly downsize. So we had to kind of let people know where we were, particularly after we had just come through the summer of racial reckoning. And we had an understanding that our sector, like all sectors, was institutionally racist and systemically racist. And just because a black man was leading the organization, it didn't mean that somehow we were free of that. It's been emotionally quite hard. And that what that's meant is that we've had to check in quite often. And most importantly, for me, I've had to understand of myself when I can lead and when I'm actually not in the mental health position or the emotional position to lead vis-a-vis certain subjects.
What does it mean to be an artistic director? I mean, most of us are used to seeing the magic on the stage, but we have little idea what's going on behind the scenes. Can you talk us through what it means to you, I suppose?
The overarching thing is that you're a curator and you're curating plays so that your art can be of service to your community, stroke communities. And however you want to define those communities, for me, my community, my immediate community is Lambeth and Southwark. That's where the Young Vic Theatre is on the cut there. Then there is the interlocking community of the London theatre goer. And then there is the further interlocking community of the British theatre goer. And then there is what are the social aims and goals of the art that we put in? What are the entertainment goals and who do we attract and bring into the building through those templates? So really the job of the artistic director is to meet the audience where they are and gently introduce them to things that they may not have known that they wanted and incrementally bring them towards that ecstatic place.
Your point about the digital revolution, do you think that has a real possibility to expand and change some of those communities as well?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, even if we think about the de-disabled community, they've had access to some quality theatre that they may not have had during lockdown simply because so many theatres are giving them access through the internet. So we know that there are certainly some specific communities that have benefited already. And I think I look at the digital revolution through the terms of access. I don't want to deprive anybody of the ability to come to the Young Vic and see a show in 3D. But if you're in Dundee, for instance, you may not be able to get down to see the show that we've got got on that's so great. But if maybe once or twice during the run, I give you access to that show in a way, again, that doesn't destroy the sense of people wanting to go to theater. But if I'm in Albuquerque and I've heard that the Young Vic is a world-class institution, there's a play there that I want to see, I go, oh, cool, I can access it. And so that's really the function, I think. Number one, access. And number two, the act of demystifying. The demystification of our rather opaque art form, and certainly the way that we produce. I think digital is going to be a brilliant way of breaking that down a little. And if I may add, so for instance, this week, I have a lighting designer, who's a very well-established lighting designer, who's shadowing me through every meeting that I have via Zoom. That's about going, okay, so you should understand how the system works, she asked, which it would, you know, I want to know how the sausage is made. I say, come into my Zooms. And all of a sudden, the digital manifestation of that allows her to have access.
In your roles as artistic director in Baltimore and now at the Young Vic, you took over in both cases, you took over from people who'd been in the roles for 18, 19 years, like nearly two decades. I mean, that's a long time. And I guess also, by the way, presumably had fabulous sort of legacies and incredible achievements of their own in both cases. But how do you usher in, how do you bring yourself to that? I mean, how do you bring your own sense of change into roles in that situation?
I think that's a brilliant question. And I was just speaking to a mentee about that actually earlier on today. And ultimately, the Young Vic, for example, David Lan, a magnificent artistic director. And once, once I got the gig, like literally every play, as was before, was five stars and transferring to Broadway and the West End. You know, I was a bit like, bruh, can you not just fail once? So I've got something to stand on. But I nearly didn't apply, not because of that, but because I was a bit like, David, I think you're doing everything that I'd want to do with a theatre. And he said something brilliant to me. He said, you know, yes, Kwame, our values may align, but I bet if I went into your house, the art on your wall is different to the art on mine. And once he said that, I went, oh, that's really clear, because your job is to make the four walls, i.e. the art, reflect who you are. Let the ball land at your right foot. And so organizationally, that's what's really important to me. I often say that I am not the colored version of the thing that went before me. And so if I inherited a system that very much was of the personality and the culture of those who went before, that I might say white Western European, that mine, which is a tricultural African man born in Britain, but claims his Ghanaian and his Caribbean roots, that I would say that all of a sudden that becomes the art that's on my wall. The sense of universality through my specific lens. And so organizationally, I came in and asked those who wished to put my art up on the wall through the lens of service, will you stay? And those who may not respond to my art, which is absolutely valid, that maybe make room for those who might.
It's a great way of thinking about it. Do you think that requires, I don't quite know how to phrase it, do you think that requires a degree of vulnerability? Because you're talking about yourself in a sense, in that you're talking about your walls, your house, your art, you. Does that require you to be or feel even vulnerable in doing that, or maybe opposite, do you need a degree of self-confidence to be able to do that, do you think?
I would describe acting like this, and all art, as the act of standing in front of someone you really fancy, stark naked, and saying, do you like what you see? Yeah. And then every applause, every chuckle, every ovation puts another piece of clothes on you, so that eventually, even though you're standing naked before an audience, you feel as if you have on a fur coat. That confidence, even though you are naked over and over again, you don't see your own nakedness. And that is what it is, I think, to be an artist full stop. You are not the boss, the ultimate boss, no matter how many accolades you have. The ultimate boss is the audience. The ultimate boss is the person looking at your body and looking at your one's me, slightly rotund stomach. I say slightly, even underplaying it, and going, oh, it's all right, isn't it? Yeah, and not worry. You know, it's an act of nakedness. Leadership is nakedness.
I really like that. So let's go back to the beginning. Growing up, you wanted to be a singer-songwriter, and your mum wanted you to be a lawyer. Theatre doesn't seem like a compromise between those two positions.
You know, I love the way that you framed that. My mother, of course, like every good immigrant, wants their children to go into what were then the safe professions. But actually, my mother wanted me to go into law as opposed to maybe accountancy. And that's not no slight on accountancy, because she wanted me to be a lawyer for social justice. Of course, we didn't call it that then, you know, but human rights. And in particular, because being born black in Britain, and particularly at that time, and it still is now, it was a very, very cold country and an extremely overtly racist country. And we faced much discrimination. And so my mother actually raised us all to want to use whatever natural skills we have to serve. And so actually, it wasn't until a good few years into my playwriting life, when my mother walked into a theatre with me, and she saw one of my plays, and she could see the effect that it was having on people, that she fully understood, not understood, that she fully appreciated that my way of serving was not through the law. My way of serving in specificity, the community that I came from, but in generally anyone who wanted to come in and partake, was through the application of heart through art.
You grew up in Southall in the 70s, well, those of us who are old enough will remember, and many of those who aren't old enough will know about the Southall race riots in the late 70s, early 80s, I think. So what impact did that have on you at the time? And I guess how did you then take that through into your work later and indeed now?
I think that's a really good question. I think my brother reminded me of something the other day, which I had forgotten. During the Southall riots, stroke uprisings, or however one wishes to characterize it, we were like 11, 12, and we snuck out of the house. And we walked up, we were walking probably about, I don't know, 500 yards away from our home on the high road. And there was a blue line. And no one had walked past the blue line. And we wanted to see what was going on, because we're kids, right? And we walked up to the blue line, and the blue line parted so that we could walk through. And then others followed. And then we got to another blue line, but this time it was blue line with barriers. And the National Front, who were having a demonstration or a town hall meeting at Southall Town Hall, they were approaching. And so we wanted to see who the enemy were, quote unquote. And so we kind of went through the barriers. Right now, I wouldn't do that now. When he was reminding me, and I remember, I was like, "Were we crazy? We could have been arrested. We could have been anything." But that restless curiosity to understand and to see up close how human beings negotiate the environment they find themselves in. The white working class feeling at that point, or some members of the white working class feeling that the only way they could reclaim the space was to fight against what they saw as the new wave of immigrants that had come in, was to push back, that that's where their power sat. That the way that those who were around us, the black and the brown, who were saying, we need to stand up to this, was again a restless curiosity. We had that. We wanted to see how the world was being put together. And I think that that has moved into my art, into the advocacy of the art, into the art I wish to produce, and also the way I wish to lead my organization. I lead my organization with a restless curiosity and a kingdom heart. In our country, I find, in Britain in particular, and having led organizations in both Africa and North America, I sometimes feel qualified to say this, that in Britain, we have been raised to date, and that probably is changing, with a kind of philosophy where often we take the clothes off the emperor rather than put them on. And sometimes I found myself in an American context saying, listen, here's this idea. And I found that the team around me will go, great, how do we put clothes on that idea? How do we stop it being naked? How do we make it? And that sometimes I have found, and certainly not the team I have now, that sometimes in Britain, we pride ourselves on going, yeah, it's not going to work because of that. And it's not going to work. Oh, you know, that's why it won't work. Oh, you know that. And kind of pride ourselves in finding the flaw as opposed to the rocket fuel to make it happen.
How do you create? I mean, do you have a, does it sort of just well up in you and you have something that has to come out no matter what else you're doing? Or do you think, you know what, I'm going to set some time aside now. I'm going to give myself a period of time and I'm going to go and create. I mean, or is it just impossible to characterize?
I would say, and I think this is in the context of this, I agreed to doing this podcast. I'm a bit bored of talking about myself, but I agreed to do it because A, I'd listened and I found it fantastic. But B, the title, No Bullshit, right? And so I'm going to try and give you the no bullshit answer, right? And the no bullshit answer is I don't know. It depends on the
That'll
day.
Do. That's a perfect answer.
Right. What I know I do is I deliberately keep a percentage of my life in chaos. And anytime someone comes in to be my PA or EA or anybody comes to work closely with me, I go, I just need to let you know that there's about 20% around me that is deliberate chaos. And I keep it that way because that is where I find inspiration.
Wow, that's fascinating. So that is not how I could cope at all. So what in practice does that mean?
You're right. It's not for everyone. And it drives some people absolutely crazy. And it doesn't mean that they're wrong to be driven crazy. It just means that they're not probably the right partner for me. What it means is that it's a little bit like the difference between improvisation and set text. That when you're on set of a movie, the director invariably goes, so look, here's the set text. Let's go. And the best actors, they're really in the scene and they can ad lib. And if your partner next to you is rigid and says, oh, but that's not what's in the script, the scene dies. But if your scene partner goes, I'm in and I know where you are, and we go on vibe until one of us decides to jump back in and we'll get to the end, then you get movie magic. And I'm in the business of trying to leave enough space for improvisation on every single idea, on every exchange. I want us to drill down. And sometimes it means in practical terms, we may have an agenda of 5 parts and we're in part one until 5 minutes till the end of the conversation. And there's some people going, can't we get on to the others? And I'm like, no, because you know what? I need to keep digging on point number one. And I have found invariably in my life that if you keep digging on, for instance, point one, and you get deep enough, you strike oil and 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7 actually come to the ground. The oil comes up all around you. That's the chaos I'm talking about, that I like to keep it moving. I like to keep it fresh and I like to keep it instinctive. Not all of the time, not for everything. If the show starts at 7:30, I want the show to start at 7:30. I don't want to improvise on that theme, you know, but in general, I try and keep 20% of chaos around me.
So you told us a story about when you were 12 or 13. So I want to talk about when you were 19, where you changed your name. Yep. From Ian Roberts to Kwame Kweama. Talk about that decision.
Yeah. Do you know what? I've never read my wiki page, right? And so I really should send someone in, because I'm told that it said that I changed my name when I was 19. It's actually, I began when I was 19 and I changed my name when I was 23. But 19 is very significant, because 19 is when I read the autobiography of Malcolm X. And I realized that what he was going through in the 1940s, internally and externally, is what I was going through in the 1980s. And I didn't have the language then, but of course it was symptomatic white supremacy that was in play globally. And so of course I was experiencing the same things that he were. And then he pulled my coat, as he would say in the old 1950s expression, to the idea that I, as someone who was Caribbean, a diasporic African, was carrying the name of someone who once enslaved someone in my family. And I found that to be illegitimate, totally illegitimate, that someone who oppressed, suppressed, and technically called me subhuman, or someone in my family subhuman, placed in a sense of inferiority into our minds where I didn't know my name or my roots or my culture or where I'd come from, that seems illegitimate to pass that on to my children. So I went on a genealogical study, took our family back to the slave fort that we came from, my great-great-great-grandfather, and then I went to Ghana, and then I what they say in the trade is I reclaimed my name.
Was that a process of you changing as well as a person, do you think?
Well, that's a brilliant question. I think that I absolutely changed once I had done it.
Mm.
I was really angry between the ages of 19 and 25, I mean 24-ish, I was so angry. I was so angry at the oppression that I had seen in my own life. I was so angry at the oppression that my parents had observed. I was so angry and outraged, and possibly even at moments of hate, at what white society had historically done to my ancestors. And it was like magic. Once I had done that act of reclamation, of saying, that will not own me. I will own my own anger if I have it. I cannot let it be owned by someone else. Once I learned to hear my mother's words, which is to hate the sin and not the sinner, I felt that a great weight had fallen from my shoulders, and I could keep my eyes, never forgetting the past, but I could keep my eyes on the North Star of tomorrow.
That's a fantastic insight. Thank you for sharing that. Obviously, it was the Black Lives Matter protests through last summer. You've already talked a little bit about those. And many organizations, many companies, I think, reviewed, changed, challenged themselves, their culture, and the change they need to make in their own organizations. I guess some with, you know, more success than others. What do you think that leaders should be doing? People in my position, and I guess you referenced also people in your position, so in the arts and more generally, in order to make that change. I guess it's important that we talk about things, but ultimately change comes through action and doing. That's certainly my view. What advice would you have for leaders?
You know, I got to say, I'm really bad on advice. and forgive me, I didn't mean that to sound confrontational. It's just that I think it's really easy to feel that one can give sage advice on things. And actually, I think that that like history is fluid, so are my thoughts, evolving on a daily basis. I would say two things. Here's what I did at my organization. We attempted to speak truth to power. We attempted to ask the people who were black, brown, and those who had experienced racism, a term I like to use is black and the global majority. We asked them of their experiences of working at the theater, of experiences of micro, macro aggressions, and of what it was to not bring their full self to work for fear of being discriminated against in whatever fashion they perceived. And I think that was really hard on the organization. We perceive ourselves, particularly at the Young Vic, of being at the forefront, at the vanguard of equality, of being, you know, right up there with diversity. And so it was really hard, as you can imagine, also being a black male running an organization, to hear these tales of pain, these tales of aggression. And then I think my job was simply to then help facilitate getting the right people into the organization, the right external people into the organization, who could take that listening and create actions. Actions that, of course, can be KPI'd, the very thing I said at the beginning that I hated using, right? And then the second or third thing that was important for me was that I, as a black male, removed myself from the day-to-day management of that. For two reasons. First of all, the bandwidth tax on people who are black and global majority to explain themselves to the global minority is really taxing and really hard. And so to be victim to it and then have to explain your pain to those who you perceive may have been party to it is a double tax. And I didn't want to, during COVID, trying to keep one's family together and trying to keep the company together, I didn't want to add that tax to me. But in truth, I felt that this was, it would be best if white people were speaking to white people on this subject, being facilitated actually through a wonderful group that is black led by called Sour Lemons. So that was important for me, A, to let the white leadership speak to the organization and speak in ways that you might not speak in front of me. And that's what was really important. Important is actually all leaders having not the politically correct conversation, not the conversation that goes, oh my God, yeah, we've been wrong. Oh my God, how can we fix it up? And what can we be? But actually speaking to your own hearts, speaking to your own fears, speaking to your own traumas around race or being called racist. And then trying to create the environment where truth can be spoken and progress can happen. And that's a really woolly way of saying, which is why I didn't say that I have advice, but my process has been listen hard and create radical solutions.
Given your love of KPIs, which we've now well and truly established, I'm not sure. I've got a feeling where you're going to stand on this, but I'm not completely clear. Where do you stand on diversity quotas or quotas generally?
I'm for it. I'm for it all the way. I see no reason. I think we have to be really mindful. Of course, we do. Of fragilities. We have to look after people, you know. It doesn't matter how privileged one is. You know, we all think and feel that we worked really hard to get here and that it's kind of down to me. And that if the pie is smaller, then my success may be smaller. And so I think we have to look after fragilities, but we also have to not let those fragilities get in the way of evolutionary, aggressive quantum leaps. And ultimately, we're serving ourselves. I don't want my grandson having the same discussion that I had. I just don't want it. And the only way we're going to do that is to make quantum leaps in terms of diversity. And let me just put this a little bit in perspective in the way that I think. For every white pound, the African Caribbean community has 20 pence and the African community 10 pence. That should tell you how many quantum leaps we need to get to before we're in a world of equality. You can't get there with small incremental acts, not in our lifetime. The same economic disparity in the United States. I think for every white dollar, there is something like 2 cents in the black community. In order to get parity, apparently it would take over 234 years. We ain't got that time. And so while we have to be very mindful, as I've said, about the notion of people feeling that they are losing something, we also have to make huge quantum leaps to allow ourselves within a shooting chance of social and economic equity.
Hmm. I couldn't agree more. And that's the approach that we've taken at Havas, which does end up, we don't call them KPIs, but it does end up with, it ends up with some numbers.
Yeah. And you know what, again, I want to be real clear. I'm jesting with KPIs. You know what? We only really know how far we've traveled when we have some measuring tool.
You do. You have to.
We just have to.
I think, and you have to actually understand your start point very clearly.
Yeah.
And then you have to say, this is what we're going to try and achieve, and this is when we're going to try and achieve it by. And you know, that's the only way of knowing whether the things you're trying are working.
Yeah, and some things will work and some things won't.
Some stuff does and some stuff doesn't.
Correct.
And I think that's, you know, that's kind of why I think it is important that people talk and say things, and it's really important. I mean, communication is critical, but communication needs to be accompanied by, and here's the stuff we're going to go and do. And
absolutely,
I think when you get those two right, that's the, you know,
absolutely,
that's the
holy grail.
Yeah, that's the holy grail. So looking back on your, well, sorry, I was reading this question now, and it suddenly makes it sound like you're about to retire. So apologies about, look, I'm going to caveat this question. So looking back from the midpoint of your career, what are you most proud of?
Somebody said something to me the other day, and I found it very, very interesting. They said, you know, they asked me a question. They said, do you talk to yourself? And I went, we all do, don't we? At some point. And then I said, and do you ever say anything nice to yourself?
I think that's a really interesting question, Matt.
And the answer was very, very rarely. So it was, oh, why did you do that? Oh, that was, it's always a chastisement, or mostly a chastisement. And seldom, if ever, can I remember that I went, oh, well done, Kwams. Oh, that was good. And so I've actively been trying to make sure that I keep in my mind the positives as I deal with a world that, you know, where negativities come thick and fast. And so that was a really long way of saying the thing I'm most proud about was directing the opening ceremony of the Festival of Black Arts and Culture in Senegal in the Senghor Stadium. And the reason I say that is because it was like the Olympics. It was a cast of 500. It was I'd written a piece of dance theater, and we, you know, and it was against a massive projection screen. It was, and you know, that took up half the stadium, and there was something about writing a piece that was about African civilization from the birth to the then present, and hearing people, 60,000 people scream or shout or applaud at a moment of the art that you've created, that was simply amazing. But it was doubly amazing because, not for the ego of that, but because the largest thing I'd directed before that was five people on the stage of the then Tricycle Theatre. And when they asked me to do the job, I thought they were joking. I thought they were just asking me to represent Britain, not to be the artistic director of this whole thing that included 52 countries from across the world. And that I had the stupidity and bravery to go, no, the process that I use for those five actors, I can use for the 500.
Hmm.
And to see that through amid many people having doubts, but that the organizers giving me their support. When I got to the end of the show, I just gave thanks, and knew that it would stay with me for the rest of my life.
If you could go back to the beginning of your career, what advice would you give your younger self? Because I know you don't like giving advice, but surely to yourself, it's okay.
I would whisper, I think, two things, one into my younger self's left ear and the other to the right ear. And the one I would say that I would whisper into the left ear is, it's going to be okay. You're going to be all right. And I would say that maybe 6 or 7 times, just so that he could be in no doubt. And then in the right ear, I would whisper, there are 1,000 reasons why you may not get a job. Just don't let your art be one of them.
That's an absolutely fantastic answer. I think that's a great point to leave it on. Thank you so much, Kwame Kweyama. It's been absolutely inspirational talking to you. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, and wonderful to meet you.
My absolute pleasure. Anything that's got no bullshit in it has got my vote.
Fantastic. I'll put that on the cover of the next book.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please take a moment to subscribe, follow, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts. We'd love to hear what you think, and your review will help others find the show. I'm Chris Hurst, and this is the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast, brought to you by Intelligence Squared. The executive producer is Farah Jasat.